Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter and on the club's YouTube channel as well. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm going to chair today's program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. 60 years ago, physician researcher Jonas Salk changed human history by inventing the polio vaccine. His work has saved countless lives, helped shape the medical field as we know it today. And recently, Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, professor emeritus at Stanford Medical School, published the first comprehensive biography of this medical pioneer. It's entitled, Jonas Salk, A Life. Today, we are pleased to have Dr. Jacobs discuss her biography of Dr. Salk, along with his work and the lessons learned from it. Dr. Jacobs will be in conversation with Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California, former secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and former governor of Arizona. Let me now just say a bit more about each. A graduate of Washington University's School of Medicine in St. Louis, Dr. Charlotte Jacobs came to Stanford as a fellow in oncology in 1975. She joined the faculty in 1977 and was promoted to full professor in 1996. She has received numerous awards for excellence in teaching and for her contributions to medical education. Dr. Jacobs also served for 7 years as Senior Associate Dean for Education and Student Affairs. In 1997, Dr. Jacobs was appointed Director of the Stanford Clinical Cancer Center, and she served concurrently as Director of the Clinical Cancer Program for the UCSF Stanford Joint Healthcare Program. In 2001, Dr. Jacobs stepped down from the director's position to return to patient care. Dr. Jacobs is known for her research in head and neck cancers and has held several leadership positions in the cancer arena nationally. Janet Napolitano became the 20th president of the University of California in 2013. She leads a university system with 10 campuses, 5 medical centers, 3 affiliated national laboratories, and a statewide agricultural and natural resources program. As UC president, Ms. Napolitano has launched initiatives including achieving financial stability for the university, focusing UC resources on local and global food issues, and achieving carbon neutrality across the UC system, she hopes, by 2025. And also accelerating the translation of UC research into products and services. She has also implemented the Fair Wage, Fair Work Plan, which established a $15 wage at UC for employees and contract workers. This is the first for a public university. From 2009 to 2013, President Napolitano was the first woman to serve as the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And from 2003 to 2009, she served as the 21st governor of Arizona, becoming Arizona's third female governor and the first woman to win re-election. President Napolitano graduated from Santa Clara University, and she received her Juris Doctor from the University of Virginia's Law School. So please welcome Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, who will be in conversation with UC President Janet Napolitano.
Well, thank you, Joe, and thanks to all who are in attendance with us tonight or who are listening in for what I think is going to be just a terrific hour of conversation. And I think we've agreed to call each other by our first names. So, Charlotte, I'd just like to start us off by asking, how did you come to choose Jonas Salk as the subject for this biography?
Well, I grew up in the time before the polio vaccine, and so I remember how frightening it was to see pictures in all the magazines or in newsreels of children struggling with crutches, entombed in iron lungs. There was enormous fear at that time because no one knew which child, which town would be the crippler's next victim. And in 1954, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis held a national trial looking at the efficacy of Jonas Salk's vaccine. They chose a little over 200 towns around the United States, and my hometown of Kingsport, Tennessee, was selected as one of the sites. And so I actually was in the original trial. I was called a polio pioneer, and I still have that little button. A year later, when that vaccine was called a success, Salk became kind of one of the greatest heroes of my generation. And so I was surprised as an adult to realize that no one had ever written a full biography of Jonas Salk, so I set out to write one.
Well, let's work our way backwards a little bit in terms of Salk's life, his beginnings, and perhaps you could talk some about his work pre-polio, what he was doing, for example, in respect to influenza, another great scourge of the 1900s, and what brought him to the field of polio.
Okay. So he, I'll scroll all the way back.
Yeah.
He was unlikely to be a great physician scientist. He was born in East Harlem into an immigrant family. He was bright but not brilliant. He was shy. His mother had told him when he was born that he was born with a caul, an amniotic sac over his face, and that meant that he was destined for greatness. And he believed her. And he really felt and used to pray as a child that someday he could perform some noble deed. So that drove him all the way to medical school. And right after his medical training, the war broke out. Pearl Harbor was bombed. And so he, who had done some research in medical school with Thomas Francis, went to the University of Michigan, where Thomas Francis was rushing to make an influenza vaccine. Now, why was he doing that? Well, an epidemic of influenza was threatening the troops, and it brought back this terrible memory of 1918 with the Spanish flu epidemic, when almost as many young men died of the flu as died in combat. So they were rushing against time, and the two of them concocted and tested the first successful influenza vaccine, for which I must say Salk did not get a lot of credit.
No.
So then he felt a little stymied by Francis, and he took a position at the University of Pittsburgh. There he wanted to work on a universal influenza vaccine. He thought that you could make a vaccine that would take care of all the different types of influenza. But he was blocked repeatedly by senior scientists. And so in 1947, when Harry Weaver, who is a talent scout for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, invited him to join them in the attack on polio, he readily joined that effort.
And it's interesting because there are some names you've already mentioned that become kind of recurrent names throughout the biography. And there are lots of very fascinating characters in the book and little mini biographies, as it were, included. But I picked five. Let's go through those five, and maybe you could describe a little bit for the audience who they were and how they would fit into the ultimate story of the polio vaccine. And I'll begin with Harry Weaver. Who was he, and why was he important?
Well, Harry Weaver worked for the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis. He was someone who kind of facilitated research among scientists, and he had an eye for talent. And he saw this young researcher who was not full of himself and would really work on exactly what the March of Dimes wanted him to work on, as compared to many other scientists who would take their money and then do what they wanted to do. And
no, that never happens.
So he was really instrumental in getting him into that group who was working on the polio vaccine. But Harry Weaver wanted to see things move along. So he and Basil O'Connor, who I'll mention in a moment, had appointed a group of senior scientists in the field of polio who were going to advise them about the best approach to polio. But Weaver thought they were kind of going pretty slow, as scientists might, you know, with thinking about, well, we have to understand a lot of the basic science, et cetera. And he saw in Jonas Salk this kind of racehorse, just kind of chomping at the bit, not because he wanted fame, but because he could see, as Basil O'Connor said, beyond the microscope. He wanted to get out there and get a vaccine. He didn't want another summer to go by with children being paralyzed. So Harry Weaver really was the stimulus behind getting Salk into the March of Dimes.
Well, and polio was seasonal, so every year people knew that there was going to be another polio summer.
Exactly.
And you just didn't know where it was going to hit and who was going to be affected.
Exactly.
So you mentioned Basil O'Connor. He's one of my favorite biographies in this biography. And talk about Mr. O'Connor for
yeah,
us.
So he's my favorite as well. Uh-huh. So Basil O'Connor was actually a law partner of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he was kind of a spunky Irishman from an immigrant family who really, you know, saw himself working with FDR, who was, you know, very classy and obviously from a very wealthy family. And he made a deal with FDR that he'd do all the work, but they'd have FDR's name in the law firm. And he became a very successful lawyer. Well, when FDR bought Warm Springs and had this idea of having a place for polio victims, Basil O'Connor said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then they had this idea of raising money to help polio victims. He said, kind of said, yeah, yeah, yeah. But then when FDR died, suddenly it all fell to his hands. Now, Basil O'Connor, he always wore a white carnation, a pinstripe suit, and his word was law. He ran the National Foundation with, you know, tight fists, and everything had to go his way.
And that's the NFIP, the National Foundation.
National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which then started the March of Dimes as a mechanism to raise money for the polio vaccine.
Right.
Well, interestingly, there was about a 20-year difference between Basil O'Connor and Jonas Salk, and they couldn't have been more different. O'Connor was, you know, bombastic. He knew exactly what he was thinking. He was strong. He was outspoken. And Jonas Salk was a shy, retiring, very kind of kind individual. And coming back from a polio meeting early on, they kind of had time together on the Queen Mary. Mm-hmm. And that's when this kind of deep friendship, bordering almost on a love affair. I mean, they just were crazy about each other, mm-hmm. and they became lifelong friends. And the little postcards and notes that they sent back and forth were just, you know, actually very endearing. And so their whole friendship weaves through the entire book. And I would say one of the saddest, most poignant parts for me was when their friendship fell apart.
And that's toward the end, over
the
issues
end.
Affecting the yeah. Salk Institute, et cetera.
Right.
And Basil O'Connor had a daughter who had polio.
Yes, he had a daughter who called him up one day and said, "Daddy, I think I have one of your diseases."
Yeah.
But she survived and actually developed a nice friendship also with Jonas Salk. So many people thought that Jonas Salk was kind of the son that Basil O'Connor never had. The scientists didn't like their friendship, and some of them referred to Jonas as the chosen.
Oh, well, we're going to get to that in a minute. But you mentioned the March of Dimes, and, you know, medical research was funded very differently in this period in our history than it is today. So talk a little bit about the March of Dimes and the whole connection of the public to trying to find a cure for this disease.
That was amazing. I mean, someone is working on a book now about just the March of Dimes, which was an incredible organization. It'll probably never happen again, but the entire public wanted to have a vaccine to stop polio. They were behind it like they were behind a war. In fact, they called it the war on polio. And the March of Dimes was actually thought of by Eddie Cantor as a concept. And they began to have posters and little canisters to put your dime in. When I was a child, if you had a dime, you know, you wanted to buy candy, but you just had to put it in that canister. Everybody was behind it, the whole nation. And the way that they were able to do that and garner the excitement of the public was amazing. So not only did them, through the March of Dimes, they funded almost all of the polio research. They funded that huge trial that we'll get to. But even more incredible to me is that that trial was carried out by the March of Dimes, mm-hmm. by volunteers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't carried out by a large research institute or a lot of high-powered, well-trained research assistants. It was carried out by school principals, housewives. Housewives were involved in doing that enormous trial and collecting all of the data and the data sheets. So it really was, the public was so engaged in that through the March of Dimes.
It was really a universal national effort focused on one disease.
On one disease.
And we're going to get to the trial in a minute, because the whole discussion of the trial and what happened is an amazing story. Two other names, though. Isabel Morgan.
So Isabel Morgan is kind of a minor character in the book, but not in the world of science. And she was part of a Johns Hopkins team that was working on polio. And one of the first things that had to be done by this group that Harry Weaver got together was to figure out how many different types of polio are there. Are they one, like smallpox? That's easy to make a vaccine. Are there 100 that change all the time, like influenza, which makes it very difficult to make a vaccine? And they were working on trying to figure out what techniques they were all going to use so that they would all agree on how to test for the different polio types. So Jonas Salk's listening to Albert Sabin and Isabel Morgan talk about which technique, and suddenly his mind goes to something else that Isabel Morgan is talking about when she's talking about her experiments in monkeys and that she used a vaccine with killed virus. Now, everybody else is arguing about, is this approach, is this... And he's sitting there going, yes, I can make a vaccine with killed virus because that killed virus that she used did stimulate immunity. Now, that's important because at that moment in the history of medicine, most of the scientific community believed that only a vaccine made with a live, weakened virus could impart immunity to prevent disease. And that had been the case with smallpox, for example, mm-hmm. and with rabies. And they all believed that, and they were all working toward having a live virus vaccine. And Salk is sitting in that room going, gosh darn it, I'm not going to tell them, but I'm going to make a killed virus vaccine, and I think it'll work. And that was, and he credited Isabel Morgan with that idea.
And she leaves research shortly thereafter because there was really no role for a woman in research at that time, and became a homemaker and lived a quieter life than she might today if she were in the
Unfortunately,
profession.
Unfortunately, that was the saga for a lot of women scientists at that day and age.
Right. That's why I wanted to pull her name out.
But, thank you.
John Enders.
So John Enders was a pretty famous Harvard professor, and he's important because everybody used to have to grow polio virus in monkeys. They had to do it in live animals because the virus needed that. And he came up with how to grow polio virus in cell culture, which doesn't sound like very much to us, but he got a Nobel Prize for it. It was like the steam engine it was created or something. Many people said, well, he should have gotten even more credit from the public. But John Enders had no interest in making a vaccine. He was a basic scientist. He wanted to work on how to grow polio virus, and he did. And
right.
But he also did not believe that you could use a killed virus, and in that he opposed Salk all the way along the way.
Right. He aligns on the Sabin line of the axis.
And I'll come back to that later because I attribute his determination as the reason for 1,700 paralyzed kids in Boston. But we'll come to that later.
I want to get back to that. Yeah, that's that. And you mentioned him a minute ago, but Thomas Francis.
So Thomas Francis had been at NYU, where Salk was a medical student, and Salk was different from most medical students. He knew at the beginning he wanted to do research and not be a practicing doctor. And he went in and asked Thomas Francis if he could work in his lab, because Francis was working on viruses. And Francis said years later, well, he was a kind of nice, presentable young man who I guess wanted to tinker in the lab a little bit. But he soon realized what a determined young man he was. So that when he went on to work on the influenza vaccine, as I mentioned, Salk joined him. Now, he kind of exits that field. He became a very prominent epidemiologist. He wasn't engaged in making vaccines. But when it came time to test the vaccine, the National Foundation, March of Dimes, Basil O'Connor, Harry Weaver took the vaccine away from Salk and said, you cannot be the person that runs or analyzes that trial. Now, why did they do that? Well, at that point in time, Salk was already starting to get some kind of bad vibes in the scientific community. That was number one. And they thought people would be suspect if he tested his own vaccine. So actually the March of Dimes, someone who had run the Red Cross, ran the trial, and Thomas Francis was selected to do all of the analysis and present the trial data in Ann Arbor, Michigan, on April 12, 1955. Interestingly, Thomas Francis would not, he was kind of a stuffy kind of statistician, he would not let anyone know what was going on. He would give no previews ahead of time. And so at Ann Arbor, where this huge announcement was going to be made, Jonas Salk was to follow him in talking. Salk found out at breakfast the morning before they started the talk, an hour before, that the trial had been a success.
It was an amazing thing. And the trial, so now you've had polio, it's the center of national attention. The president has been a polio victim. You have the nation's school children and everyone else raising dimes. Everybody's trying to find a vaccine. And everybody knows that there's going to be a trial. But it's not a little human trial. There have been some smaller human trials before then in places like homes for children with disabilities and prisons, et cetera. But the real trial, the one that everyone thinks of now, is the 1954 trial. Maybe explain for the audience the scope of this trial.
Yeah. So this was probably one of the biggest trials in the history of medicine, certainly in the United States. It was conducted solely in children, first, second, and third graders, at 211 sites around the United States, and over 1.5 million children participated in this trial. That's astronomical. There were actually two trials going on at the same time. The major trial was that children were randomized between just a placebo or the vaccine. And it was double-blinded, so no one knew who got what. And amazing, again, housewives ran this trial. They were the ones responsible for randomization and for determining who got what and collecting the data. I mean, that to me still just boggles my mind. And then the second part of the trial, because Basil O'Connor had already told some of the states they could do it that way, everybody in the second grade got the vaccine in those towns, and they were compared to the first graders and third graders in terms of incidence of polio. That's what happened in my hometown, so I knew I got the vaccine. So it was an incredible trial and carried out magnificently.
Mm-hmm. And I just have this picture of Francis and his team of statistics gatherers, you know, picking up these cards being sent in from all over the country, assembling the data, analyzing it for months. There were no computers. This was all, you know, handwritten stuff coming into Ann Arbor. And they select April 12, 1955, to announce the result of the trial, which is a significant day for another reason.
Well, that was the death of FDR. Now, Francis said, I selected that date because they gave me a choice of five dates, and that was the longest one, so it gave me more time to do the analysis.
That sounds like Francis, right, yeah.
But all the naysayers said, oh, no, it was for publicity, it was for publicity. And they said, and Salk chose that date for sure because he wanted the publicity.
Right, right. And Salk had nothing to do with it. No, I mean, Salk got blamed for a lot of stuff that wasn't his fault. Yeah. And, and so Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was everyone was paying attention. What was Francis going to announce? And this is a marvelous section in the book where you just describe that day in Ann Arbor. Can you give a little flavor of how organized it was and everything went
according
to Hoyle?
Well, first off, that's not the way that scientific advances, you find out about them, right? I mean, you know, what he normally would have done is he would have written up the results, he would have had peer review in a journal, it would have been published, and then afterwards he would have given a talk about it. Mm-hmm. And maybe it would have made the news. That was the standard. But this was in the form of a news conference. And it was at this beautiful auditorium at the University of Michigan. And there were 150 reporters with their all their cameras and equipment and whatnot all in the back of the stage. And they were promised that they could get the results ahead of time. They were upstairs waiting, but they had to keep it secret. Well, you can imagine the minute that those packets of results came out, it was a free-for-all. They just all swarmed the guy that was handing them out, immediately got on the ticker tapes and everything else and started saying...
Totally broke the embargo, right?
Yeah, exactly. Dave Garraway was the first, and he said his excuse was, well, it was just too good to keep secret.
Yeah.
So upstairs, chaos is going on, and they... And it starts downstairs. No one's heard anything. And Thomas Francis gave an hour presentation in a very measured, scientific way, going through the methods, et cetera. And, you know,
with
45
charts.
Minutes into it. Oh, yeah, charts and everything. As if you were giving a scientific. 45 minutes into it, he said, and now the results. And, of course, everybody went crazy. And the minute that he announced that, in fact, it had reduced the incidence of paralytic polio by about 80%, the world went crazy. I mean, people were honking horns. There were sirens going. There were prayer meetings held. People were out in the streets cheering, hugging each other, writing thank you, Dr. Salk, all over their stores. It was, as many people said, like the end of a war.
Yeah.
And then Jonas Salk got up to talk, and, you know, he was the public's darling.
Right.
They just loved him. And he honestly thought that the next day he would go home and go back into his laboratory and start doing research. He really didn't have a clue that he had just become the world celebrity.
Right. In fact, Edward R. Murrow pulled him aside at the end of the morning and said, basically apologized and said, I'm sorry this has happened, that you discovered the cure for polio because now you've lost your anonymity.
Yeah.
Another thing that happened in the midst of all this is, as Salk is, he thanks the NFIP, he thanks O'Connor, but he forgets to thank or acknowledge his team from
Well, he acknowledged them, but he didn't acknowledge them by name.
Ah, okay.
You know, he said the ones who worked on it.
Right.
And they were all fairly devastated, very, very angry. In fact, most of them left his employment afterwards. I mean, that was the other thing. I mean, there were only about five of them who were working on this whole vaccine.
Right.
That was incredible in itself.
Right.
Just to show you how angry they are, I already got an angry letter from one of the son of one of the people that worked there. I had no idea where he was. No one knew, saying, you know, some pretty nasty things about Salk. Now, Salk afterwards tried to retract. He felt very bad about it when he was given a presidential citation. Again, he tried to mention them, but the damage in their minds had been done. Their names weren't on the publication of the final results, but neither were Salk's. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Francis and his statisticians were on it, but they weren't, and Salk wasn't. But they were all very angry at Salk, and they're still the only a living relative is angry today.
Right. So talk about somebody who's angry and who comes across as an angry man throughout this whole book, Sabin.
Yes,
okay.
Albert Sabin.
So... Maybe, and it's interesting because he and Salk both had very similar backgrounds from poor Jewish immigrant families in New York. I think Sabin was a few years older than Salk. Describe the source of their animosity and the intensity that it had?
I must say, by the way, that Albert Sabin's daughter spent enormous time talking with me, as did two of the Salk brothers. And so I've gotten it from both sides, and actually they're all pretty much in agreement, and the children have become friends. That's kind of interesting. So this was called one of the great medical feuds of history, and that bothered Salk because it wasn't really true. Early on, Sabin acted very much as a mentor to Salk. They would send notes back and forth to each other, best personal regards, how's your family. At meetings, they'd stay up late and talk to each other till after midnight. But that was when Sabin thought that Salk was going to do his bidding. Sabin believed, as most scientists, that you had to make a live virus vaccine. That's all that would work. And Salk didn't really tip his hand. He thought he was right in, everybody thought he was right in lockstep behind Sabin on the way to make this oral vaccine that was going to take several years. When at one of their meetings, Salk announces that, in fact, he's made a killed virus vaccine, and he's tested children and shown that they can have antibodies. Well, that really drove Sabin to distraction, and then when they went on to test that as the vaccine, even made him more angry. But early on, Salk used to say, and Salk, there wasn't a rival. They say there was a race. I don't think, Salk wasn't in a race against Sabin. He was in a race against this polio that was killing people and maiming people.
And every year's delay was another 50,000 children.
So Salk used to say, this isn't a rival about two people. This is a rival about a principle. Do you do a killed vaccine or a live virus vaccine, which in itself he worried could actually cause polio. But as time went on, after the vaccine had been approved, and 4 years later, paralytic polio was reduced by 90% in the United States, but the scientists still believed that the Salk vaccine was just a stopgap until they had an oral live virus vaccine. They all still believe that. Sabin tested one. He tested it in Russia. It was safe. It was effective.
In the middle of the Cold War.
In the middle of the Cold War. That's a whole story itself. And in the early 1960s, the Public Health Service recommended switching and using the Sabin vaccine, citing cost, it was much cheaper, and convenience. You could just get it in a sugar cube. But there was a lot of the basic scientists working beneath that. There was a lot of politics as well. Salk was very upset about that. He tried to get that decision reversed. He was worried again that it would actually cause polio. And all the major medical decision makers, the CDC, the FDA, the American Medical Association, everyone turned a deaf ear to him. And by 1968, no one made the Salk vaccine in the United States anymore. So Salk spent the rest of his life trying to get the Sabin vaccine delicensed because, in fact, people did get polio from that vaccine. It was a small number. The vaccine was entrenched. The scientific community was behind Sabin. And so Salk just became tenacious in trying to reverse that decision. And that is where the rivalry really started to heat up. Mm-hmm. But again, Salk never said a bad word about Sabin. He was always very gentlemanly. Sabin...
The reverse couldn't be said.
Sabin was bombastic, and he was a leader. He was very well known in the scientific community, very well respected, and gave a lot of grief to Salk.
Right, right. And then other scientists kind of seemed to line up on either side of
Yeah,
of
there
this.
Weren't too many on Salk's side. They were all weighted over on Sabin's side.
Yeah, yeah. But, and Sabin... he made some pretty big mistakes as well as in his own research. How would you assess the relative value of the vaccines today in the sense of which ones are in current use?
Yeah. So it has a very interesting history. Then as time went on, Salk worked with a company in France to try to make a better a newer version, better polio killed vaccine virus. And that actually, the Sabin vaccine, because people got polio, was delicensed, but it was about 4 years after Salk had died, that his vaccine, which is the only one used in the United States and in most developed countries now. Now, it's very ironic that we will probably get rid of polio someday because of both vaccines. And they're probably both rolling over in their grave right now when they hear that, because they weren't exactly friends toward the end of their lives. Because the oral vaccine is much easier to give and much less expensive. So in third world countries, the oral vaccine is what is being used and has been responsible for many, many improvements. Interestingly, though, if you look, like in 2014, there were 414 cases of polio around the world. 55 of those were caused by the vaccine. So, because it can revert to a more virulent form. So clearly, you can't get rid of polio forever with the oral vaccine. So what the global polio eradication initiative, which is, you know, this wonderful, wonderful initiative to get rid of polio worldwide, they have a three-step kind of process, and eventually, after they get the last case of polio from the wild vaccine gone, then they're going to switch back and only have the Salk vaccine and retire the Sabin vaccine. So in the end, it will only be the killed vaccine, which is what most people, well, everybody today in the United States gets.
There was actually an article in the New York Times, I think, last week about they're down to one last case that they've found in Africa. So
yeah, but unfortunately, there's still a few in Pakistan, Afghanistan.
Yeah, and there are reasons for that, which we might be able to get into. But in the we are going to pause. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest is Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, Emeritus Professor of Medicine at Stanford University and author of a new biography of Jonas Salk, inventor of the polio vaccine. I'm Janet Napolitano, President of the University of California, and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio. Catch up with us on the club's YouTube channel as well. So there goes the commercial announcement. But back to the Salk-Sabin dispute, feud, call it what you will. Neither one won the Nobel Prize.
No. I do have to say one last thing before I forget, because I thought it was very telling. Jonas Salk always said, I hope someday that my biographer won't pose our rivalry as two little Jewish boys from the Bronx fighting it out.
Yeah. Well, and you
so
didn't.
I did fulfill his wish.
And you didn't. They never won. Enders, who John Enders at Harvard. Now he won a Nobel right in the middle of the trial, actually, for discovering that you could grow the virus in non-nervous tissue. They didn't wait till the trial was actually done.
Yeah, it didn't
done.
Matter. Because, I mean, what he, in terms of cell cultures, applied to lots of different viruses.
Right,
and so it was
right.
A major step forward in science.
In science. But in terms of polio...
Yeah, so Jonas Salk never got the Nobel Prize. He was nominated multiple times. And actually, of course, all of the information about the committees and the nominations was held under lock and key. But last year, or maybe it was the year before, some of that information was made public. And there was actually then a book written about the Nobel Prize and a section about what happened to Jonas Salk. And interestingly, there is a five-man committee that would look at the nominations, and there was a Swedish scientist named Sven Gard who was on that committee and always wrote up Salk. And he didn't like Jonas Salk.
No.
He said he couldn't reproduce his results. And right after the Salk vaccine came out, there was a, let's call it an industrial accident, where quite a number of children actually got polio because the vaccine hadn't been inactivated correctly. He blamed that on Salk, and he said that Salk really didn't make a discovery of any merit. Well, first he said, we have to wait till the trial's over. And then the next year he said, well, the trial was successful, but, you know, maybe it could have happened another way, and it wasn't a major scientific discovery. Now, Salk told Robert Gallo, the big AIDS scientist, well, I guess it doesn't really matter because everybody thinks I got the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, right.
But I think more egregious and more telling, because I'm not sure when I look at the definition for the Nobel Prize that he really was a candidate for that. But the National Academy of Sciences, he was blackballed from. I mean, that to me was just egregious. And those records are not available, but I did able to interview a people who were around at that time who went through the process, and that one person could blackball them. Amazing. And they said, well, they were sure Sabin blackballed him, but there were plenty of scientists standing behind him who also didn't like Jonas Salk. And so he never got into the National Academy. In fact, he got relatively little recognition from the scientific community. And that was actually one of the questions I had that drove me to write this book. Why? Well, one reason, do you want to hear the reasons?
Yeah,
do you have
no,
other questions?
I mean, I'm going off track. Well, I know a little bit about politics, and I must say, reading about the politics between the scientists would give you gray hair. I mean, these guys are intense, but go ahead.
Well, so, you know, what kind of underlay their disdain or their kind of rejection of him? Well, first, here he was, this young scientist. He wasn't a member of the scientific brotherhood at that time. And he tests a vaccine behind their backs and challenging their tenet that was so deeply religiously held about live viruses. So that was number one. Number two, they said, well, he grabbed the limelight and took all the credit, and he didn't mention the other scientists, not talking about the people in his lab, but about the other big scientists. Well, Salk did try to mention them, but the media made him the icon for the polio saga. The public didn't want to hear about John Enders and Dorothy Horseman. They wanted to hear about Jonas Salk. That's who they cared about. So he had been made a media star, in a sense, and they really didn't like that. But the third, and I think this ties into something that you said at the National Academy of Sciences, he reached out to the public in the way scientists didn't do. He felt that the public had funded this trial, they were behind this trial, and that he owed it to them. He tried to answer every single letter. He gave interviews to Parent Magazine, to Good Housekeeping. He went on television and showed the public how you make a vaccine using a Waring blender. Now, that did not sit well with these scientists who'd built these big walls around academia, and so he was kind of accused of academic, his decorum wasn't quite good, and of pandering to the media. But let's face it, he garnered more celebrity than almost any scientist, physician scientist, with the exception maybe of Pasteur. Mm-hmm. So you can't discount jealousy. That's one of his friends said, don't discount jealousy. It's amazingly strong in the field of medicine and science.
Oh, yeah, my heavens, yeah. And as you mentioned, he's never made a member of the National Academy of Science. He's not inducted into the Institute of Medicine till the very end of his life, because all he did was save, you know, a minimum probably 500,000 children from getting polio. That's all he did. So same dynamic, I suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are their notes kept confidential as well?
No, but when I asked the Institute of Medicine about it, they wrote back this little short note. He is to a member. It was just that he was
80 years old. Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't. So.
Yeah. So it gets into, you know, when we talk about the politics of it, whatever, you know, he's also involved in it right around the time televisions are becoming in every household. The media landscape is changing very rapidly. You've had this huge media campaign. You can think of the March of Dimes as really a huge, almost like a crowdsourcing campaign in a way, to raise the money for the vaccine. And the other scientists, to me, just seem to be kind of clueless about that and what it would mean for the future of medicine and medical research. Did you get the same sense as you were going through it, that he was somehow prescient in that regard?
In terms of the media?
Yeah.
I think he had a funny relationship with the media. He learned very early on how he could use the media when he needed to use them.
Exactly.
On the other hand, they drove him crazy at times. I mean, he'd be walking across the street and someone would put a microphone in front of him, what did you have for breakfast? And he didn't want to talk about his personal life. Mm-hmm. And so he really had this kind of a love-hate relationship, although he was always kind and generous to the media.
Yeah, yeah. So. Very open to them. You just mentioned his personal life, so I'd like to switch a little bit to that. He was a workaholic. The members of his lab team were similarly working all the time. The race against polio was a huge deal. But can you describe, you know, how he actually had time for a personal life? Did he have one? And let's move on to what he does post-polio.
Okay. So, no, he didn't have much of a personal life. His wife, who was a very accomplished woman and a social worker, really believed in him, although that got a little tiring after a while. His three sons barely saw him. But the media had pictures of him flying kites with them, reading to them, having a barbecue. Well, those things didn't happen. And by the time they were teenagers, they were all sent east to boarding schools. Well, after there was so much celebrity, because not only did they have a legendary father and husband, they became celebrities by association. His wife could never accommodate to that, and mm-hmm. their marriage eventually ended in divorce. Mm-hmm. And then subsequently, is that what you wanted me to mention?
We're going to get to that in a minute. But he goes back to Pittsburgh. He's now an international celebrity. The president has, President Eisenhower choked up, recognizing him at a ceremony in the Rose Garden. You know, this is the man who led the Allied forces in World War II, and he chokes up over Jonas Salk. He and Pitt never really saw eye to eye after he got back, it didn't seem like. And he conceives this idea. He wants a new thing to work on. He wants a new project, and he becomes interested in how you unite science and the humanities, or human evolution writ large. And he moves out to California. You want to talk about the founding of the Salk, what became known as the Salk Institute?
So he actually, and Basil O'Connor have been talking about this ever since they met on the Queen Mary, so it wasn't totally a new idea, but then when C.P. Snow had a book, The Two Cultures, that just sparked him. So he wanted to create an institute where scientists and humanists worked side by side. He called it imbuing the sciences with the conscience of man. And Basil O'Connor bought into it, provided enormous funding. He hires Louis Kahn, who designed a magnificent architectural institute that they placed in La Jolla on the bluffs overlooking the ocean. Fabulous. He was able to attract some outstanding scholars and almost all Nobel Prize laureates. Everything's going to be wonderful, and he faced nothing but problems. He had an architect who had more fun dreaming than drawing. He tried to run the institute himself, and his own administrative skills were so lacking that they were always on the brink of bankruptcy. He had a falling out with Basil O'Connor, which was exceedingly painful. They had a later president who said, "I can raise more money with Salk dead than alive," and Salk heard that. And final deposal by the very scientist for whom he had built this Shangri-La. But the most painful thing to him in the end was that the sciences trumped the humanities, and it became just a scientific institute. Not just a, I mean, it's a fabulous scientific institute. And he later in life said to one of his friends, when he said, "Well, aren't you happy? Look at this great institute." He said, "I'm only half happy."
Right, right. Because he was always thinking ahead. You know, he really strikes me as someone who rarely rested in any event.
No.
I mean, he was...
I don't think he ever watched television or went to the movies or any of that. He just worked.
Right. Well, he worked and he socialized with women.
Okay, yeah. So I wasn't looking for this. I was talking to John Cohen, who wrote a wonderful history of AIDS. And out of the blue, he says to me, "How are you going to deal with the skirt chasing?" I said, "The what?" He said, "You know, the skirt chasing." He said, when Carter wrote a book on the history of polio, he said, "I really can't mention that." So I let it ride for a while. And then I saw on the internet a woman who started talking about all the time she spent with Salk and how it broke her heart. And I talked to her. And then, you know, one person led to another person, to another person, to another person. And I could begin to hear stories. And there weren't that many, but what they were all about is that Salk, in later life, he became much of a philosopher. He had a lot of ideas that he wanted to get across in metabiology, but he couldn't really express himself in ways that were accessible to the public. So he started looking for people who would kind of be his torchbearers, and they just happened to be young, very bright, very attractive women. And so what started out on an intellectual plane at some points would evolve into a physical relationship. Now, I really didn't know whether to include this or not. And, of course, I pestered my husband, should I, shouldn't I? Two of my friends who were here in the audience, we'd have dinner, should I? But then I heard so many biographers who had been criticized for withholding parts of people's lives. And this is a full life. And so I thought what it really showed was that Jonas Salk was human. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a saint that he was portrayed by the public. And that he was a very solitary, lonely man, and he was searching for some special connection with someone, and he never seemed to be able to find it. Mm-hmm. He did tell one of his friends, who was a close friend of his wife, perhaps in explanation. I learned very early on, he said, that everybody getting into their pants has to get into their pants one leg at a time. In other words, I'm human too. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, but it also struck me that having been basically not blackballed, but shunned by the scientific establishment, the awards he got were all on the civilian side, not the scientific side. He seemed to me someone who was always looking for approval or validation wherever he could find it.
Well, it is interesting. So I had a lot of interviews with a friend of his later in life, who was younger than Salk, who is a psychiatrist. And so, of course, he had a lot of theories because he knew about the liaisons that he had and whether this, you know, was this a way of him showing the scientific community, well, you have your awards, but I got this lovely lady on my arm. Uh-huh. But that doesn't sound like Salk to me. I think his son, who is a psychiatrist, who never acknowledged the affairs, but he said his father was always looking for a special connection, and he could never find it. He could never connect with people, and that's why he just kept on working.
Yeah. Not even with François Gillot?
No, so François Gillot...
Another one of my favorite biographies, subsumed in the biography, but yeah. Go ahead.
So François Gillot is a French artist, she's still alive. And she, besides her art, she became quite well known because she published a very popular book called Life with Picasso, which details her years as Picasso's mistress. Salk, now a free man after his divorce, met her actually at the Salk Institute, and she really had no interest in him initially, but realized the depth of him beyond science. He had a great interest in art and architecture and whatnot. And so he pursued her, and she told me the story of when he proposed, and she said, well, we're both older, I don't see a reason to get married, and I'm not sure it'll work. And he said, well, here's a piece of paper. Write down all the things that would have to happen that you think to make it work. And so he left the room, and he came back a few minutes later, and she'd written down a whole long list, and he looked at it and said, yeah, I can do all of these things. Well, one of those, and she didn't tell me what they all were, except one, and that was that she could spend 6 months a year in France or in her studio in New York painting mostly alone, because she was a very career-driven and an accomplished
quite
artist.
Quite an accomplished artist herself.
Now, yeah. Friends were shocked about that. They were shocked that he married her to begin with. But then they realized that he looked happier and healthier than he ever had and started actually doing things besides just working in the laboratory. He had longer hair. It was in nice waves. He wore a silk ascot. And
yoga. Don't forget yoga.
Yeah, he got into yoga and Rolfing, all of that. I like his sister-in-law said, yeah, she Frenchified him. But what happened is that kind of wore thin for some reason. Over the years, they became a more intellectual than really affectionate couple. And I thought it was really telling I'll go back. Francoise is very straightforward. I did get to interview her. She just cuts to the chase, you know, tells it like it is. And so Jonas was kind of horrified when Charlie Rose was interviewing her and said, well, how did you end up with two of the most famed men in history? And she said, lions mate with lions. Well, of course, Salk was just humiliated about that. So, but later in life, when she was interviewed...
Don't you love that quote? I just
That was one of her famous quotes, favorite quotes from the book, she told me. Françoise was being interviewed, and they asked her about how she enjoyed being at the Salk Institute and La Jolla, and she said, if it weren't for my husband, I wouldn't spend 5 minutes in La Jolla. Well, of course, the press did not like her.
Right.
And
right.
So, but they stayed together.
They were together until his death. And
yep.
And they had their deal, as couples do. You know, the other thing is, when Salk, he's at the Salk Institute now, he's in La Jolla, he has to, you know, he has an architect who's a brilliant architect, but slow and expensive. He's got Basil O'Connor's cut him off from that fund. I mean, he's constantly having to raise money. The whole unity between the humanities and the sciences is not working out. But also, it seems like he has his own, he still has a lab. And it seems like he's still trying to stay in the research game. Was he successfully able to do that?
He worked on cancer, which really showed that he knew nothing about modern molecular biology. And in fact, it was such an embarrassment to the other scientists at the Salk Institute, they connived to shut down his laboratory. He worked on multiple sclerosis and actually was well-regarded in the multiple sclerosis world. But he kind of hit a blind alley. He was doing a therapeutic, and it caused bad allergic reactions. After he had retired or was retired from the Salk Institute, he was sad. I mean, he thought that was the end of his scientific career until AIDS came around. And he was busy writing philosophical books and whatnot, and then suddenly this terrible disease is hitting young gay men, and nobody knows much about it. And it's almost as like he put on his armor and got back on his steed and charged right into the AIDS arena. And it was amazing, kind of, some of the people were going, really? You know, this old guy tilting at windmills, what is he doing here, trying to regain his former glory? But other people thought that he really did some credible work. And in fact, he formed a company, Immune Response, or helped form it, and made a vaccine, a therapeutic vaccine, to delay the time between infection with HIV and full-blown AIDS. And actually, that vaccine is still under, evaluation today, or a more modern version of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't do science the way he used to be able to do it, just, you know, go in and do it. Now there were all kinds of regulations, and the FDA watched over everything. And he was kind of in a time warp, which was very, very difficult for him. And he was, in fact, arguing with the FDA about starting a national trial of his vaccine when he died.
So, as we...
And he was 80.
And he was, yeah, but he was still at it. I mean,
yeah, he was still
trying to do good, yeah. Which was something his mother had instilled in him from childhood. In today's modern medical research establishment, this goes to some of the questions from the audience, do you think there's still the opportunity for... a scientist in a lab to do what a Salk did in the late 40s and the 50s?
I doubt it.
Or is it so different now?
I doubt it. I tried to compare at one point. If he were trying to make a vaccine today, the first thing is he'd have to do all the basic science work. And there is no March of Dimes. There is no fairy godmother just ding, giving you money. He'd have to write an R01 grant. Now, I think the latest figures are maybe 16% of R01 grants from the National Institutes of Health, probably less than that now, are funded. And he never wrote a successful grant in his life. So he probably would have been, you know, cut off right then and there. But had he been able to get that money, or from donors, although it takes an enormous amount of money, then he would have had to go through an investigational new drug application. He would have had to go through all the animal trials. And, of course, right then and there, the minute that he was working on monkeys, all the animal protection people would have been breathing down his neck. He would have been tweeted about multiple times a day. He would have never been able in secret to do his work, because you can't do secret research with national funding anymore. And then he would have had to go through phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials in children. Really? I mean, the protection for children in clinical trials now is enormous. And just an investigational new drug application, any of you that have participated in a trial know, is about 20 pages long compared to one paragraph that he had for the for his initial trial. Then he would have faced all the people against vaccination. My husband, who's in the biotech world, and I, well, mainly him, calculated it would take $500 million to $1 billion to go from beginning to end, and probably take about 10 years. Salk made his vaccine in 3.5 months. And from the time that they started working and the trial was completed and it was licensed that very day was 3.5 years.
Right, right. Yeah, there.
So the answer is, I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, it's a different world. Better.
Better, probably. I mean, that was a is a totally different historical time. You can't do what he did now.
Right.
Once thalidomide, the protection walls went up, and they should.
Right.
And they should, but there has to be a way to expedite research when it's critically important for the national good, and I think that has to some extent you see with Ebola.
Right.
Which, ding, 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 kind of moves things along a lot more quickly.
Right, right. And that was one of, and this was one of one of the disputes, I think, or the seeing beyond the microscope quote that you referenced earlier, but it was really about, it's not just about the science, it's about getting and preventing children from getting polio and getting to that point as quickly as possible. What do you think, in the end, lessons learned from Salk's life? Now, you've spent close to a decade working on the biography. What lessons do you derive?
Well, a lot of lessons, I guess, one about the role of science and the individual. And his whole relationship with the scientific community, the role of politics in science, the rules of academia, and how those have to be—they have to be a little more fluid to allow someone who was—he was a very unconventional scientist in order to thrive. So I think that is one of the major ones. And the other is someone who, the word now is bench to bedside, translational science, et cetera. I mean, he was a translational person. He went from bed to bedside like that within a few months. But the facilitation of that, I think those are some of the major lessons learned.
Where would you place him in the annals of the history of medicine? Where would you rank him if we were to do such a thing?
I think it's hard to rank because of whether you're ranking basic scientists or clinical scientists, but I think he made one of the major contributions in the history of medicine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, he was responsible for the prevention of polio and for influenza, which we didn't even touch on very much. And despite anything, no one can take that away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's his place in medicine. So interviewing a lot of basic scientists who would, go on about his AIDS work and how silly it was, or, look, he made that simple vaccine with a kill virus and on and on and on. These very pompous scientists would then turn to me and go, but he sure did one of the greatest things in the history of medicine.
Yeah, right. And in the end, we tell the tale of the tape. I think that's probably a good place for us to stop this great conversation. It's a terrific book, by the way. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And there are so many things in there that are merit even more discussion than we had time for this evening. Thank you so much for devoting your time to helping explain to us in language that is very accessible to non-scientists, but contains a lot of science, the life of this very, very enigmatic man.
Thank you.
Really, it is terrific. So our thanks to Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, professor of medicine emeritus at Stanford, and author of Jonas Salk, A Life. And I want to thank as well the audience here on the radio, for those of you watching on television and over the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Janet Napolitano, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.